Our fourth case for argument this morning is United States against Stratton. Mr. Rath.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Douglas Rath. I'm a court-appointed attorney for Julia Stratton. The issue I think that is the greatest error committed by the district court judge is the application of a six-level increase to the base level offense for the possession of 25 or more firearms. The judge was able to come to this conclusion based on the testimony at the sentencing hearing of two individuals, Sylvester Rice and Roy Christopher Brunt. She also took into consideration the plea agreement of Arnes Brunt. The problem with the six-level increase is that the defendant conceded or agreed at the very beginning that he should have a four-level increase. He admitted that he had at least 8 to 24 firearms. The problem is that after we get to the number 8, the evidence is very inconsistent, and as the court would read the transcript and compare the testimony of Brunt with Rice, I mean, in many ways, they're not even talking about the same situation. This is a situation where there was firearms purchased in Mississippi, and the initial question was, how did the firearms get purchased? And we have Rice saying that he used his own money to purchase firearms from a pawn shop in Clarksdale, Mississippi. We have Brunt saying that he gave Rice the firearms. We have Rice saying he purchased two firearms. He gave the guns to Brunt. We have Brunt saying that he received one gun from Rice and got the second gun off the streets. Rice says he travels with Brunt to Chicago on four occasions. Brunt said that Rice and him came together to Chicago only once.
But the district court acknowledges that there are some inconsistencies, and she tries to eliminate and take a conservative approach. Why isn't she entitled to dig down and see which things are really just innocent differences in recollection and which things really show that there is some different account going on? I mean, she could have believed one and not the other, for that matter, if she wanted to.
I think the judge clearly said that it was her opinion that the testimony of the two individuals were, in fact, though minor inconsistencies, but she was able to reconcile in her own mind. So I think, to answer your question initially, she took into account both of their testimonies. She dismisses some of Rice's testimonies as saying that he's maybe mentally at a lower level.
Right.
Perhaps he's not as well-educated as Brunt might be. But the problem we have here, judges, is that we simply don't have any good sense of where this upper level is. We know that we certainly have no problem with a four-level enhancement. It's the extra two-level enhancement because the evidence is so unclear, it's contradictory, it's in tremendous conflict, and therefore the
To repeat what my colleague's question was, I entirely appreciate this contradictory business, but that's why we have district judges. The district judge considered this and made a finding of fact. Your burden is to show that the finding is clearly erroneous, and I haven't heard you even try to shoulder the burden. You're essentially repeating the kind of argument that would be made to the district judge. That's wasted on an appellate court. You have to show us that the district judge's finding is clearly erroneous. Now, why was this finding clearly erroneous?
Well, as I say, let's turn to the Arnes plea agreement. This court has specifically said that if a plea agreement is going to be taken into consideration, since it clearly would be hearsay, then it has to be corroborated by the kind of testimony that would allow an appellate court to believe that the plea agreement should be relied on.
When you're talking about sentencing in particular, Hearsay is fine in sentencing. There are fundamental requirements of reliability, yes, and sometimes those can be satisfied by corroboration. Sometimes they might be satisfied other ways. But I'm not sure that plea agreements as hearsay are different from all the rest of the hearsay that comes in sentencing.
Well, in this court's case in United States versus Hankton, the court said a plea agreement could be used at sentencing hearing so long as the plea agreement included a sufficient indicia of reliability to support their probable accuracy, citing another one of the court's case, United States versus Taylor. The court said a plea agreement might pose hearsay problems and cites 801, but says plea agreements were more, in that case, were more than sufficiently corroborated at Hankton's sentencing hearing by the credible testimony of two live witnesses.
Right, and that's exactly my point. Maybe that one was corroborated from external things. Maybe some other plea agreements are so replete with facts that you look at it and you say, well, this one appears to be reliable in and of itself to use in sentencing. The key is reliability at sentencing. The key is not whether it's hearsay or non-hearsay. So that's why I think you might be overreading Hankton
a bit.
Well,
to answer Judge Easterbrook's query to me in terms of what is clear error, I would say that the district court should not have relied. It was clear error to rely upon the plea agreement of Arnest Brunt because it did not supply the sufficient detail and reliability that you, just Judge Wood, mm-hmm. have just talked about. That, to me, is a clear error. We can certainly, even assuming that the district court judge was correct.
Argument about clearly erroneous finding. This is a disguised argument about the admissibility of evidence. I certainly hadn't understood your brief to be contesting the admissibility of the evidence. Maybe that's wrong.
Well, I believe in my reply brief, Your Honor, that I had made it clear that I was taking the position that the judge improperly and was clear error to rely on the plea agreement of Arnest Brunt. That's the position I took. The only other issue I'd like to focus on for just a minute or so is the consecutive versus concurrent term. The guideline range called for a sentencing of 63 to 78 months. The statutory maximum for this particular offense was 5 years, so that was what the 5 years was imposed.
So the judge is concerned if she doesn't impose a consecutive sentence, his sentence for this gun conduct is effectively zero because there was a different case dealing with his drug activities that you wanted it to be concurrent with, but it's hard for me to see how that abuses the discretion she has under the guidelines. The
judge clearly has the discretion, and a proper use of her discretion would have been essentially an incremental increase if there had been.
I don't understand that, though. I mean, you're saying it's automatic, so 59 months, 58, 57. I don't see why when there is a 60-month sentence, she can't just say, you actually did something else bad. You illegally distributed firearms, and so you're going to have to serve the time for that.
And she was, it was certainly
appropriate. It's not going to be overlapped with some other offense you can.
Well, then that brings me to my final point, which this court has consistently rejected, but I will bring it up once more, and that is the disparity of the sentence within the same case. And I know this court has said time and time again it's a national overview, but when we have a situation.
No, that's not right. That's not our position. Doesn't make, no. No. We have said that in cases, but the Gall case makes clear that's not a correct position.
So
but there are relevant differences in this case between the defendants.
Judge, there are differences, but as I pointed out and I made the mathematical comparisons, the effective sentence for Julius Statham turns out to be so much greater than any other defendant. I understand that there are reasons to give different defendants different sentences, and there is certainly evidence in this case, particularly toward a cooperator. But I do not believe that the sentence that Julius Statham received essentially was fair. My primary concern, I have addressed my concerns, and I'd like to reserve whatever time for limited rebuttal.
I would think that's probably about 25 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Maybe 24. Mr. Cole.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, the district court correctly found that the defendant had trafficked in at least 25 weapons. She took an extremely conservative approach to doing that. And there was conflicting testimony in some respect, but she resolved it. She resolved it in a way that gave the defendant every reasonable doubt as to how many guns, the minimum number of guns that he could have trafficked.
Well, under the version of the guidelines she was using, she just needed to get it from 24 up to 25, right?
That is correct.
Yeah.
Brunt gave her at the minimum 20 that she used, that he personally had brought to Chicago, putting aside the weapons that he brought to Chicago and sold to the defendant on behalf of other people or with other people. Although Sylvester Rice testified that he brought more than two guns to Chicago, the district court only relied on the two guns that he brought to Chicago during the one trip that was corroborated by the other defendant, Brunt. As to the Arnes Brunt plea agreement, first of all, that was not anything that the defendant objected to at the time of the sentencing hearing.
The introduction of the plea agreement.
The introduction of the plea agreement came in without any objection at all from the defendant during the plea hearing. And in fact, it was corroborated in the fact that the defendant in his plea declaration actually said that he purchased guns from Arnes Brunt. He didn't mention the number of guns, but he certainly did indicate that he said directly that he purchased firearms from Arnes Brunt. And so that is corroboration of the plea agreement of Arnes Brunt. In respect to the consecutive sentence versus the concurrent sentence, the district, this was a big topic of discussion at the sentencing hearing, and the district court raised the concerns that this court has already articulated, that if there were a concurrent sentence imposed by the district court, it would mean that this totally separate crime of gun trafficking would go without a penalty, and the district court, after considering the appropriate factors under 3553A, such as the different aspects of the crime, the different goals of the conspiracy, the defendant's own prior history with the justice system, the fact that he showed really no rehabilitation over time, concluded, appropriately so, that the sentences should run consecutively.
Now, were any of these co-defendants mentioned by your opponent also involved in the drug side of things, and did they get...
No, they were not.
Okay,
we're
looking at apples and oranges then.
That's exactly correct.
Yeah.
That's exactly correct. So unless this court has further questions, I ask that it affirm the judgment of the district court.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, counsel. You have about half a minute left. Anything further?
10 seconds. Your Honors, the government counsel said that there was an admission in the plea declaration where Statham says that he bought guns from Arnes Brunt. The plea declaration simply says between August 2001 and July 2002, Mr. Statham asked his cousin Arnes Brunt, a Mississippi resident, to purchase firearms. There was nothing more than that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Rath, we appreciate your willingness to take the appointment in this case.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.